what I understand, it's difficult to get a since the only way we can communicate and the only way that ICE and CoreCivic are letting there to be communication right now is through phone calls. But what I imagine is it's pods, like units. So there can be from 100 people in one unit to 70 people. You know, the numbers vary between among units. But yeah, there are it's social distancing and being able to, you know, follow CDC guidelines. It's impossible to do so inside of these places. And there have been cases where people who have gone to medical units and come back positive have been sent to the same units again to be with other people. And yes, we know with this, with the pandemic, with COVID, it only takes a little bit for it to spread to everyone. So that is in the conditions that they're in currently.
Ruth, we want to thank you for being with us. Also, this latest news, a federal judge in California has ordered ICE to urgently review the cases of prisoners most likely to suffer from the severe illness, these outbreaks of COVID. And he condemned the system-wide inaction in responding to the outbreak. Currently, about 31,000 people are in detention, in ICE detention. Ruth Mendez, volunteer with Otay Mesa Detention Resistance in San Diego, thanks so much for being with us. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is working with as few people on site as possible to protect against community spread. The majority of our remarkable team is working from home. I want to give a special thanks to our general manager, Julie Crosby. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam
Allen. We're the fifth graders from David Douglas Tag Center. We listen to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
Hey, KBOO supporters, this is Kat Miao, KBOO's board president. Due to the COVID-19 crisis, KBOO has had to cancel our annual spring membership drive. Canceling such an important fundraiser was not an easy choice, but thanks to an anonymous donor, every dollar contributed now through May 31st will be matched up to $20,000. We know that times are tough right now, so we're asking those of you who are able to give to donate today at kboo.fm/give. Financial support from our listeners is what allows community radio to carry out the important role we play in times like these. Give today at our website. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Thanks for your support, and thanks for tuning in.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon Health Authority has announced new testing guidelines during the COVID-19 outbreak. The FDA has approved the first at-home test for the novel coronavirus, and U.S. oil prices have hit a historic low. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 21st, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. As of Tuesday afternoon, there are 202 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Oregon. Health officials also announced 3 new coronavirus-related deaths on Tuesday, bringing the state total to 78 people. The Oregon Health Authority has announced new coronavirus testing guidelines. The agency said that if supplies allow, people without symptoms living in within group living systems, such as healthcare, long-term care, and corrections facilities, can be considered for testing. The agency still urges people with mild symptoms that do not require medical evaluation to stay at home until at least 72 hours have passed without a cough or fever. Meanwhile, Governor Kate Brown sent a letter to Congress on Tuesday asking for more federal funding and economic recovery packages for Oregon's coronavirus-related needs. The letter requests federal funding to support local hospitals, long-term care facilities, and small businesses. Brown also asked for more funding for unemployment insurance, rental assistance, and food assistance. Nationally, as of Tuesday afternoon, there are at least 793,000 cases across every state, plus Washington, D.C., and 4 U.S. territories. At least 39,000 patients with the virus have died. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 2.4 million people across 177 countries. At least 169,000 people have died. Governor Kate Brown is under fire from Republican lawmakers to reopen the state and allow business to resume, with an emphasis on rural communities where few or no virus outbreaks have been reported. State officials, along with locals, are urging Governor Brown to lift restrictions on her stay-at-home order. Currently, nearly half of Oregon counties have reported fewer than 5 confirmed COVID-19 cases. Proponents to the argument weigh economic strains caused by the coronavirus outbreak are damaging businesses, especially in smaller towns where support is needed. Senate Republican leader Herman Bashtiger of Grants Pass said in a press release Monday, quote, "The rural districts in my caucus should be able to return to a new normal and get back to work. State health leaders are saying not enough testing has been done, and to allow businesses to reopen at this time would be too soon and irresponsible, with evidence of 2 weeks of a downward infection rate statewide being the determining factor necessary for a lift on those closures." Monday, the governor's office announced Oregon's potential 3-tier guidelines for a possible ease on closures, with an emphasis on childcare facilities and restaurants. Phase 1 would allow restaurants, sports venues, theaters, and churches to reopen with a strict protocol on sanitation and distancing. Wineries, bars, and brew pubs are a segment hit especially hard, and considerations are being addressed, while the second and third phase recommendations spar with early suggested federal guidelines, with larger groupings of people allowed at businesses being suggested. Brown maintains, however, that according to models in other countries, reducing social distancing too soon can result in a spike in infections. The governor's potential plan additionally seeks review from the Oregon Health Authority, Brown's medical advisory panel, and local public health officials. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved the first at-home test for coronavirus. The tests are issued by LabCorp and allow users to swab their noses at home. The sample is then sent to the lab, and results can be returned in 2 to 4 days. This is the first and only at-home test to be approved by the FDA so far, and LabCorp has stated they will give priority to frontline workers and first responders. The benefit of an at-home test is that it doesn't require a clinician, which reduces the spread of disease and the use of personal protective equipment. While clinician tests swabs deep inside the nose, at-home tests only require people to swab the inside of the nostril, a much less invasive alternative. The test costs $119. Around 150,000 tests for COVID-19 are done in the United States each day, though, according to experts, that number is still far too few to bring the outbreak under control. Tomorrow is the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. Andrea Sears has more on that story with the Public News Service.
Wednesday is the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, and to mark the occasion, environmentalists are having a virtual gathering, urging the state of New York to continue its commitment to healing the planet. The COVID-19 pandemic will have a huge impact on the New York state budget, but environmentalists stress that it will be vitally important to maintain state support for programs that protect our water, air, and wilderness areas. According to Bobby Wilding with Clean and Healthy New York, the virtual event will include dialogue between environmentalists and state policymakers about where to direct state resources.
It's really about investing in the future and making sure that our state continues to be in a leadership position.
The virtual Earth Day 50 meeting will take place from 1 to 2:30 p.m. Wednesday. Registration information is available on the web at chny.org/earthday. Wilding says the virtual event will serve as a public forum for discussions about ensuring continued funding for programs such as the Clean Water Infrastructure Act and the Environmental Protection Fund.
We're going to talk about the issues, and we're going to connect with some of the key legislators who make decisions year in and year out about what kind of policies get enacted.
A joint letter being released by 24 environmental groups also urges the state to bring the Restore Mother Nature Bond Act to voters in November. Wilding says New Yorkers' cooperative effort to stem the spread of COVID-19 shows what can happen when people come together for a common goal.
There are a lot of steps that we could be taking together that would help prevent lots of other problems that we're facing. And so I feel like it's a moment where we can see our power, and I'm inspired for what's going to come in the next 50 years.
For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
Artists are being summoned to address Portland's growing landscape of boarded-up businesses during the time of coronavirus. Portland Street Alliance is calling out to visual artists to help bring some color back to the streets of Portland, asking temporarily closed businesses to adorn their property with murals. The nonprofit hopes that by adding art to the barren landscape that much of Inner Portland has become, morale will be boosted, streetscapes will be beautified, and out-of-work artists will have a chance at getting their visions realized. The organization suggests donations from $5 to $25 per square foot for temporary installations, offering alternative options to businesses that are unable to afford payment right now due to COVID-19 economic strains. No businesses to date have requested work from artists, according to Portland Street Alliance, but are encouraged to participate by email to PSAA directly at info@pdxstreetart.org. Community response via social media has been supportive, with locals embracing the idea of temporary murals reflecting the resiliency of the local spirit during this unprecedented time. Wolf pack populations are growing, according to data from the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, with an increase of 20 animals for 2019 in Washington and growing numbers in Oregon. With a suspected 158 animals roaming the state, Oregon wolf populations have grown 15% since 2018, despite reported incidents of conflicts with ranchers ebbing this year. 22 distinct packs have been observed, with many clustered in the northeastern region of the state, with officials noting how ranchers are handling the increase with ingenuity. A wolf advocate from the Center for Biological Diversity, Amarok Weiss, says the news is encouraging and hopes trends facing forward continue. Weiss said to Oregon Live, quote, "We're excited to see wolves move into new places, and that Oregon didn't kill wolves last year for conflicts with livestock. The animals are also making inroads into parts of western Oregon, with new packs surfacing in Lane and Douglas counties. The Pacific Northwest wolf population was all but eliminated in the 1930s, with gradual increases of numbers beginning in Washington in the 2000s. Washington confirmed 21 lethal removals in 2019 due to cattle deaths. Gray wolves have been classified as an endangered species in Washington since 1973. Oregon law maintains the animals have been considered endangered since 1980. Conflicts between wolves and livestock in Washington still face challenges, as animal advocates are urging state managers to enforce the stopping of slaughters. U.S. oil prices hit historic lows yesterday with an unprecedented negative price. This development has been bad for important economic indicators like the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which finished today down 600 points. The drop in value for U.S. oil and international prices is due to a mismatch in supply and demand. While people around the world are consuming far less fuel due to stay-at-home orders related to coronavirus, oil companies did not decrease their supply. Now there is an overabundance of oil and nowhere to store it. Traders are not paying to buy oil, but rather paying someone to store it. American oil companies face a tough decision: continue to sell oil at rock-bottom prices or shut down wells, which itself is very expensive. As a reaction, President Trump has instructed his Treasury Secretary to come up with a plan to make money available to the oil and gas industry. He tweeted today, quote, "We will never let the great U.S. oil and gas industry down." Oil prices outside the U.S. have slumped too, with one international benchmark down 31%, the lowest since 1999. The death toll in the worst mass shooting in Canadian history has risen. Kibu Zalkan has the story.
It is now confirmed that the death toll in the shooting rampage by a 51-year-old gunman in Nova Scotia, Canada, has risen to 19. The shooter, who has been identified as Gabriel Wortman, first killed his former girlfriend and her new lover before roving about the northern and central areas of the province in a car disguised to look like a Royal Canadian Mounted Police cruiser. Wortman also wore what may have been an actual police uniform or an authentic copy, using this disguise to pull over drivers and knocking on residents' doors to gain access to his victims. Among those killed was Constable Heidi Stevenson, a 23-year-old veteran of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Stevenson had attempted to stop him by ramming his vehicle with her cruiser. Wortman shot her in the chest and dragged her from her cruiser and shot her execution style. He then took her gun and vehicle after setting fire to his own. Through the 12-hour rampage, he set fire to 5 residences and carjacked several other vehicles attempting to elude police. Wortman's killing spree was ended when he was cornered at a gas station in a rural area and shot dead. Authorities are expecting to see the number of victims to raise when they can gain access to the homes that were burned in order to search for more dead. For KBU News, I'm Al Khan. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Totality of Circumstances. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX, then at 7, Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an occasional rain and low of 50 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy with a high of 62. Today in history, in 2016, legendary musician Prince was found dead in his Minnesota home. Over his lengthy career, Prince won 7 Grammy Awards, as well as many other accolades. He was 57 years old. The quote of the day is from Prince, who said, quote, "Despite everything, no one can dictate who you are to other people." Voting rights groups want to move local elections in Virginia from May 5th to November 3rd due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Diane Bernard has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Concern over public gatherings during the coronavirus crisis has spurred voting rights groups to press Virginia's General Assembly to move the date of local elections from May to November. The legislature is set to reconvene Wednesday and will vote on Governor Ralph Northam's recommendation to consolidate all upcoming elections on November 3rd. Claiming that people should not have to choose between their health and their right to vote, Jean Honwich, an activist in Chesapeake, says she doesn't want a repeat of social distancing violations seen during the recent Wisconsin election.
We should be focusing on public safety, not having people gather to vote. And we've all seen the disturbing images of Wisconsin, of people in long lines with masks on. And the reality is a lot of our poll workers are older, and it's putting them at risk too.
She says more than 100 Virginia cities and towns, including Hampton, Chesapeake, and Norfolk, are set to vote in races for mayor, city council, and school board positions on May 5th. Honwich says another reason to move the election is because voters can't make informed decisions since candidate forums and community events have all been canceled during the pandemic. In addition, she points out that elections tend to favor incumbents during low voter turnouts.
The incumbents are the ones that are going to benefit from keeping elections at a time when there's low turnout. Like our mayor, he does roundtable videos. It's like he can do that because he's already our mayor. But the other candidates don't have any vehicle to do anything like that.
Meanwhile, the ACLU is suing Virginia to get the Commonwealth to cancel the witness signature requirement for mail-in absentee ballots during the coronavirus crisis. For Public News Service, I'm Diane Bernard.
Yesterday was the anniversary of the Columbine school shooting, and Students for Biden and Every Town for Gun Safety held a virtual town hall. With more on the story, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
21 years, different presidents, different leadership, and we have yet to fix this problem.
The father of a Florida Parkland school shooting victim condemning the lack of meaningful gun safety legislation on the anniversary of the Columbine shooting. Fred Guttenberg moderated a virtual town hall co-hosted by the Biden campaign and Every Town for Gun Safety, an advocacy group largely financed by former candidate Mike Bloomberg. To the north, Canadians are mourning the deaths of at least 19 Nova Scotians in their deadliest mass shooting ever. Their gun laws are more restrictive than the United States, and mass shootings are rare. While polls show steps like universal background checks are largely supported by Americans, gun control is hard to get through Congress or state legislatures. Laws for or against gun regulation often come through ballot initiatives. One problem this year is gathering enough signatures to get initiatives in front of voters.
Everyone is doing the best that they can to ensure that, you know, the impact on the 2020 ballot measure landscape is minimal. But whatever happens, we need to still have the conversations around these issues, regardless or not of whether they make it to the ballot.
Chris Melody Fields Figueredo, executive director of the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center, says they're working to help the 24 states that allow citizen petitions to modify their processes for COVID-19. Oregon is one of the states that already allows online signature gathering. Devin Downey-Smith is with Yes on IP44, a measure to change the state's approach to addiction to rehabilitation.
It's part of our campaign strategy to eventually move to digital signature gathering, and COVID just accelerated that timeline. We were really lucky that we were so ahead on signatures.
Last week, a federal judge denied requests from two Arizona campaigns to allow electronic signature gathering during the pandemic through a secure system called Equal. Primary candidates in the state already use it to get their qualifying signatures, but the court ruled any changes to the ballot measure process must come from a state constitutional amendment where the procedure is outlined. Rod McLeod from Healthcare Rising explained why his group, along with Arizona for Fair Elections, went to court.
Without online signature verification, I think you're going to see fewer measures on the ballot. And so the people's right to legislate using the ballot, I think, will have been infringed.
In Massachusetts, though, the state Supreme Court decided last Friday to allow some electronic signatures and to cut the required number for candidates to qualify for primaries in half. One plaintiff was Melissa Bower Smith, a state House candidate. As Smith recovered from a respiratory illness, the pandemic hit, and now she needs more signatures, and some are likely to be rejected.
Because they're in the wrong color ink, or somebody has written their name instead of put their signature, or they made a tick mark next to their name in the place where the town clerk is supposed to write.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Great Plains tribal leaders call for the removal of the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs, and a Native nonprofit raises millions of dollars for a tribal COVID-19 response project. With those stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Great Plains Tribal Chairmen's Association is calling on the Trump administration to remove Tara Sweeney as U.S. Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs. The group sent a letter to Trump administration officials last week accusing Sweeney of seeking to divert emergency tribal COVID-19 aid to Alaska Native corporations. Cheyenne River Sioux Tribal Chairman Harold Frazier chairs the Great Plains Chairman's Association. He says this is not the first time Great Plains leaders have felt slighted by the assistant secretary. Frazier says he made a motion in November to call for her removal after a lack of consultation with the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
I just feel that, you know, she just isn't really looking out for Indian country or any of the people that live in Indian country. To me, it just appears that, you know, we're just a number, and we are human beings, and we deserve every right to be treated as such, and at least that potential that somebody's looking out for us, and I just feel that she's not taking the interest of Indian people.
A statement to National Native News from the Department of the Interior reads, Assistant Secretary Sweeney is committed to supporting all American Indians and Alaska Natives, and to suggest she has personal motives or that she's attempting to divert funds away from American Indians is completely false. The statement goes on to say, it's unfortunate that during a time of historic appropriations for the Native American community, some are seeking to divide the community and are suggesting to ignore the mandate of Congress and exclude eligible entities as defined by law. Meanwhile, the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe is filing an injunction against the Department of Treasury and Interior Department over the $8 billion in COVID-19 relief aid set aside for tribes in the CARES Act. A Rapid City, South Dakota organization is supporting Indigenous communities during the COVID-19 pandemic with medical supplies, food, elder care, and other aid. Indian Collective has raised more than $3 million, as China Lockett reports.
NDN Collective was started a few years ago to support Indigenous leaders and efforts. Now, they've changed their focus to funding pandemic relief. Nick Tilson is the president.
Less than 0.5% of all philanthropy in America goes to Native communities. And this is an issue the Indian Collective has been trying to address since our creation a couple years ago.
Tilson says there is federal aid for tribes and indigenous communities, but the money isn't coming in quick enough, which can be dangerous. He says since many indigenous communities are already underinvested, this can put more stress on first responders, emergency management, and individuals.
And so this is designed to provide gap funding, immediate support to those organizations and tribes and communities out there that are providing direct and essential services to their community.
That includes tribal healthcare systems, nonprofits, businesses, and grassroots efforts. Tilson says their priority is getting protective gear and essential material to communities on lockdown,
along with additional medical equipment, additional food and supplies for young people that are in the Indian welfare system, supporting some of the elderly care facilities and veteran facilities that are out there.
Nick Tilson says the collective has built relationships with philanthropic institutions over the years that helped them raise money for pandemic response quickly.
When we made the decision to make our other work essential and to not reorganize existing dollars, we leaned on our philanthropic partners and said, hey, we want to build a fund for Indian Country. Will you go in partnership with us? Can you help make this happen?
So far, the NDN Collective has raised more than $3 million. Their plan is to get to $10 million. For National Native News, I'm Trena Lockett in Rapid City.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
An oceans advocacy group is calling for a Blue New Deal. Their goal is to protect ocean health and help coastal communities adapt to climate change. Dr. Anthony Leiswitz has more on that story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leiswitz, and this is Climate Connections. As the climate warms, sea levels are rising, tropical storms are intensifying, and ocean waters are growing more acidic. These changes to the oceans have major impacts for people on land, from flooded coastal communities to losses for the fishing industry. David Helvarg is executive director of Blue Frontier, an ocean and coastal conservation nonprofit.
Hundreds of millions of people and tens of billions of dollars are at risk if we don't start to address what we're seeing in terms of the impacts of fossil fuel-driven climate change on our coasts and oceans.
But he says the ocean is often overlooked in climate policy discussions. So Helvarg's group is lobbying for what some refer to as a Blue New Deal, a comprehensive set of policies and programs to protect ocean health and help coastal communities adapt to climate change. For example, they want to see policies that reform the National Flood Insurance Program and protect critical fish habitat. They also advocate for restoring coastal ecosystems that can naturally buffer storm waves. Helvarg says prioritizing oceans and coastlines can save lives, strengthen the economy,
and restore a healthy and vital ocean that so many of us grew up with.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
The water levels on the Great Lakes fluctuate naturally throughout the year. With more on that story, here's Current Cast.
The cycle of high and low water in the Great Lakes on this Current Cast. When the water level in the Great Lakes fluctuates, it affects everyone differently. From commercial shippers carrying heavy loads to lakefront property owners concerned about erosion. Keith Kompoltowicz, Chief of Hydrology for the Detroit Corps of Engineers, says the water level in the lakes varies frequently.
The lakes fluctuate anywhere from 1 foot to 16 inches or so on average over the course of the year.
Snow, rain, and runoff cause the lake levels to rise through the spring and early summer, peaking in July. In summer, drier conditions combined with evaporation cause the water level to drop until midwinter. Then the cycle begins again. Because the Great Lakes are a shipping hub, the changing water levels can have a rippling effect throughout the country. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 21st, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Al Kahn and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Lily Bolke, Andrea Sears, and Diane Bernard. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website, kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. At 9, we'll hear Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon, which brings Washington County residents the information they need to engage with issues in their community. At 9:30, it's Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw, arts, culture, and politics with hip-hop as the guiding light. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, Art Talk Bus Stop features guest Renee Sills, Portland-based artist, astrologer, yoga teacher, and somatic instructor. All of these wonderful KBOO programs are made possible by support from listeners like you. If you'd like to support us, go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for Totality of Circumstances.
Thank you for listening to KBOO Community Radio. This is Totality of Circumstances. We're on every other Tuesday at 5:30 p.m. right here on 90.7 FM in Portland, and at all times and all places on kboo.fm. We put this show together from home in an effort to avoid spreading or contracting COVID-19, a very terrible and contagious disease of which you are probably aware. Those of us who can spend at least the majority of our time at home are lucky to have the privilege. This week, we're going to focus on how the novel coronavirus is affecting prisoners in state and local jails, and the variety of official responses. Scientific authorities have made grim projections for the spread of coronavirus in so-called congregate settings like prisons, elder care homes, and shelters. The CDC has released interim guidelines for managing COVID-19 in jails, but a number of agencies, from the Oregon Justice Resource Center to the Drug Policy Alliance and the National Association of Social Workers, have called the CDC's guidelines for prison settings inadequate to actually protect both prisoners and staff. In a class action lawsuit against the governor and the Oregon Department of Corrections filed April 6th, the Oregon Justice Resource Center has this to say about the CDC's guidelines. Quote, "The CDC guidelines fall far below community standards of preventative medical care. They fall short of the standards set by the governor of Oregon and the governor of neighboring states to reduce the transmission of COVID-19 among the general public. They fall short of the CDC guidelines to reduce transmission among the general public. This shortfall is particularly acute due to heightened transmissibility of COVID-19 within prisons. And finally, they fall short of the recommendations of experts in prison health care and epidemiology." End quote. And all of that was to allege that state prisons, in this case Portland's Columbia River Correctional Institution, or CRCI, are falling short of even the most basic, already inadequate standards set by the CDC. This includes failing to provide soap or making prisoners pay for it, failing to require symptomatic prisoners to wear masks, failing to quarantine prisoners for 14 days after they came into contact with an infected corrections officer, routine failure to provide prisoners with opportunities to space themselves 6 or more feet apart, and so on. Tensions at the prison resulted in lockdowns at two of its units on April 8th after 2 days without soap, when prisoners confronted guards who had just told them to remove protective face masks. That's according to reporting by Alex Zielinski of the Portland Mercury, which has had the most detailed and up-to-date reporting on the COVID-19 crisis in state prisons. A prisoner who spoke to the Mercury after the incident said, quote, "It feels like the state is gambling with our lives. We can't take that," unquote. Whether they have adhered to CDC guidelines or not, prisons across the country have already seen large outbreaks of COVID-19 that far outstrip the rates of infection in the general public in the same region. As of yesterday in Ohio, for example, the prison population accounts for an estimated 20% of the state's positive cases. That includes nearly 2,000 positive cases among prisoners and staff at just one Ohio State prison. That's an extreme example, but also the result of an aggressive testing program, which found infections in people without symptoms. The vast majority of prisons in the country do not have an accurate picture of COVID-19 in their populations because they just aren't testing everybody. Last week, Oregon Department of Corrections officials sent Governor Brown, at her request, a list of potential scenarios for releasing up to nearly 6,000 prisoners of the state, which the Oregonian obtained in a public records request. That number would be just over 40% of the state's prison population of around 14,500. That's how many prisoners the DOC says it would need to release to comply with social distancing guidelines. They identified 182 prisoners as quote-unquote most vulnerable, and another more than 600 as vulnerable, with the rest being either over 60 years old or up to 12 months away from release. The report divided each category up by whether or not the prisoner was serving a mandatory minimum sentence under Oregon's controversial Measure 11, which has been credited with leading to a rise in Oregon's prison population over recent decades. Governor Brown could have released all 6,000 recommended prisoners. She could have released a few thousand non-Measure 11 prisoners. She could have released only several dozen of the most vulnerable prisoners. Instead, last Tuesday,
In answer to your question, and the question was, do I plan to early release adults in custody as a result of the COVID-19 crisis? The answer is no, and certainly we will provide you with the documents that I have used in my decision making. Look, all of our state agencies are wrestling with the impacts of the COVID-19 crisis. I have asked all of my agency directors to share with me their plans for protecting their staff, their employees, and for protecting their customers, their clients, their adults in custody. And certainly am concerned about COVID-19 and the presence in our prisons in Oregon. I have reviewed the plan with Director Peters. They are working hard to make sure that our adults in custody and the staff remain safe.
In an interview with the Mercury's Alex Zielinski, a prisoner at CRCI said that he was part of a group of 40 men watching the governor's press conference. When Brown said she wouldn't release prisoners, there was a, quote, violent reaction. In the days since the lockdown on April 8th, the CRCI administrators had set up an unprecedented series of meetings with representatives from each of the prison's 8 units. One of those representatives told the Mercury that the meetings were an insult, with administrators repeatedly interrupting the representatives as they read demands and generally failing to answer questions or provide reassurance. The meetings left the prisoners feeling, quote, unheard but also disrespected, unquote. What about the local jails here in Portland? On March 16th, there were 1,144 people imprisoned in the Multnomah County jail system. That includes the main county jail, the Multnomah County Detention Center, which we'll be calling MCDC for the most part, and the Inverness Jail in northeast Portland. All told, they have beds for just under 1,200 prisoners, meaning that 5 days after the county declared a state of emergency over the novel coronavirus on March 11th, the system was still near capacity. Over the next week, from March 16th to the 23rd, when Governor Kate Brown instituted Oregon's Stay Home, Stay Safe rules, the number of prisoners in the county system fell by almost 250. During this period, according to the Oregonian, quoting Metropolitan Public Defender, 10 to 15 people per day were given pretrial release without a hearing for various reasons. The sharp drop continued for another week, and the jail population has leveled out in the low to mid 700s since then, at around 60 to 65% of its capacity. In a recent article by Maxine Bernstein in The Oregonian, she writes that the county's juvenile jail has also reduced its population to about 53% capacity. The releases continue even as about 30 people are booked into the jail every day. The drop is due to a handful of factors. The two county jails function primarily as transportation and holding centers and see heavy traffic in and out every day, in addition to people being held on the orders of the U.S. Marshals and those awaiting trial or bail. In mid-March, local law enforcement agencies, including the Portland and Gresham Police, the district attorneys and sheriff's offices, and the county circuit courts, released new policies to stop the spread of COVID-19. Sheriff Mike Reese detailed some of the measures during a press conference on March 13th.
Because of the risk of exposure, as of today, we are no longer allowing social visitation at our two jail facilities to help prevent any further spread of the virus. This will not impact professional visits. Those in custody will still be able to meet with their attorneys. They can still connect with their family and their loved ones in our jail facilities, as they are already equipped with telephone and video conferencing kiosks. As you can imagine, practicing social distancing in a jail facility is challenging. We've opened an additional dorm at Inverness Jail to create additional capacity. Each year during the cold and flu seasons, correction staff allows for enhanced cleaning of our facilities and our dorms. Our employees and adults in custody are constantly encouraged to maintain good hygiene, and information is displayed in our dorms on monitors around the clock. This ensures everyone receives pertinent information. We're also aware that some justice-involved individuals may have compromised immune system and diseases. Because of this daily concern, we already have robust infectious disease procedures in place, and our staff are well-trained on personal protection equipment and policies and protocols to follow. Corrections health staff are also in our jail facilities 24/7, 365 days a year to assist us. Our patrol and in our facilities, we're limiting interactions among our staff and holding virtual roll calls and teleworking where possible. We don't take these decisions lightly.
Somebody had a question about, for visitors and kiosks, is that going to cost money for people to access their loved ones?
That's a great question. We have kiosks in our jail facilities that allow people to contact their loved ones that are in custody, and those visitations are free. So if you have a loved one that's in custody and you want to contact them, we're not allowing social visitation right now, but you can come in and use video conferencing or the telephone link to access your loved one.
That was Sheriff Mike Reese last month. A number of the measures taken by the city and county have been effective in reducing the jail population by releasing people with 10 or 20 days left to serve, and by having cops issue citations instead of arresting people for misdemeanor charges. On a press call that was released as a Police Bureau podcast, Portland Police Chief Jamie Resch explained the Bureau's policy.
So the other thing that we did in conjunction with the DA's office is we have reduced the folks that we are taking to jail. We are citing all misdemeanor crimes. Basically, the people that we are taking to jail are felony custodies and all mandatory arrests, since there's domestic violence. So I think that's important for the community to know that we are taking felonies and mandatory arrests to jail. So that's been messaged out a couple times, and I think that's very important.
The Police Bureau's Public Information Officer, Lieutenant Tina Jones, gave some more context to misdemeanor citations on the same podcast while answering a question from the Portland Mercury.
Like from the officer level, it's what's referred to as a criminal citation. So instead of someone going to jail, if we're able to verify their identity, then an officer would issue, it's similar to like a traffic citation, except it's a crime, not a violation. So they would be given a court date, and then that would be up to the district attorney's office as far as the follow through. The officers would still write and submit their reports. And really, it's, you know, part of the efforts to mitigate the number, the volume of folks who are currently in jail, and also due to the staffing at, you know, the courts and with the district attorneys, their ability to process those sorts of things as well.
Incidentally, there is very little aggregate data out there to help track misdemeanor citations, where they're given, and the demographics of the people they're given to. Portland, Multnomah County, and the state of Oregon all do not regularly or consistently publish data on misdemeanor charges. The Oregon Judicial Department did release a so-called annual report in 2016, and hasn't since, and that counted 46,000 misdemeanor cases in Oregon that year, a decline of 10,000 cases from 2012. The Multnomah County DA released an annual report in 2014, also the last one from them, which showed that the office reviewed 16,000 misdemeanor cases that fiscal year. Despite this lack of data, misdemeanor offenses are an incredibly important part of the criminal justice system. According to a 2018 study called The Scale of Misdemeanor Justice from Boston University, they outnumber felony cases about 3-1 nationwide, and about 13.2 million are filed each year for crimes ranging from assault to sleeping on the sidewalk. We reached out to the city and county for any data they were able to share about any rise in misdemeanor citations since COVID-19 measures were put in place. We haven't heard back in time for this show, but our webpage will be updated with any information we receive. The last time the Police Bureau released any official messaging on how they would enforce the governor's stay-at-home order was in a March 26th press release, saying it would seek to educate the public first before issuing citations as a last resort. These citations would be for quote-unquote interfering with a peace officer and for violating the executive order, both misdemeanors. But some misdemeanor arrests have continued, and they still make up a vast majority of charges for people booked into MCDC. That's based on a quick glance at everybody booked into MCDC this past Sunday, April 19th. 39 people entered the county jail system that day, 10 of them with felony charges. Aside from a county hold and a contempt of court arrest, all of the remaining 27 people were in for misdemeanors. The police did state that they would be booking people into jail for misdemeanor domestic violence, which accounts for 9 of those arrests. The remaining 18 include 2 for drug possession, 4 for DUI or reckless driving, and 12 for a variety of charges including violation of a restraining order, trespass, unlawful possession of a loaded gun, reckless burning, not arson, mind you, and third-degree theft, which means less than $100 value. That means that people are still being booked into MCDC for drug and poverty-related offenses, and release is not necessarily likely anytime soon if they cannot post bail. We have been aggregating MCDC booking data for the past month, and it shows that even though the jail population is declining, there are still spikes over the weekends, presumably when court and county staff are off work. In the current pandemic, a few extra days in a busy and confined environment like a jail can mean life or death. Multnomah and Washington counties have at least taken some measures to get in line with the social distancing protocols ordered by scientific authorities. In Washington County, the sheriff says the jail has limited itself to 1 prisoner per cell. In other Oregon counties, however, the story is different. On March 24th, an inmate at the Columbia County Jail in St. Helens, northwest of Portland, filed a class action lawsuit against the county, the sheriff, and the jail supervisor. He was represented by the Oregon Justice Resource Center. The plaintiff cannot post bail, as he faces multiple felony charges, and suffers from prediabetes, asthma, and congestive heart failure, all of which are significant preconditions for people faced with exposure to the coronavirus. The suit alleges that the jail has failed to follow the most basic precautions recommended by the CDC and has thus violated prisoners' constitutional rights under the 8th and 14th Amendments. The suit detailed the ordeal of one former prisoner, who we won't name. The prisoner was booked into the jail in November 2019 and spent the next 4 months in a cell with 3 other prisoners and, quote, never spent time more than 6 feet away from other CCJ inmates, unquote. He observed one of his cellmates getting sick, sneezing and coughing all day and night in the cramped space. In early March, the prisoner himself got sick, and on March 15th it intensified, with symptoms including fever, body aches, sneezing, and coughing, and he was moved to isolation. In isolation, he wasn't given a mask to prevent the spread of his contagion. He was nevertheless told that he may be, quote, contagious. The jail kept him in isolation until March 23rd, during which time he was never tested for COVID-19, nor was he seen by a doctor for his flu-like symptoms. Two nurses visited him twice daily in his isolation cell. Neither wore masks or gloves. On the 23rd, he was released back into general population in the same close quarters as before, and if he wanted to wash his hands properly, he had to buy soap from the commissary, and so did every other prisoner. He was released from jail the next day. The suit goes on to describe how the plaintiff, with his multiple compromising medical conditions, lives in the exact same prison conditions as that former prisoner. As of last week, one staff member at the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office had tested positive for COVID-19, and 15 prisoners and staff in the Oregon State prison system had. This whole show, we have talked about what state and local officials are doing, and more often not doing, but there is a lot of attention being paid to this issue at the community level through advocacy and direct action. The prison abolitionist group Critical Resistance has called on local leaders in the criminal justice system to enact a series of changes that would address not just immediate concerns related to COVID-19, but also the deeper systems of enforced inequality and exploitation that the COVID-19 crisis has made obvious. In addition to immediate release of people at increased risk from the virus, they demand that all sentences of life without parole be commuted, the immediate release of all people being held pre-trial, the reduction of policing to decrease arrests, a complete stop to all so-called quality of life policing, and the release of all people held in immigration detention centers. Critical Resistance continues to facilitate letter-writing campaigns for Oregon prisoners as well. Other organizations that provide direct services to prisoners during these times are the Portland Freedom Fund, which provides cash bail assistance for people of color and people in poverty, and Metropolitan Public Defender, a nonprofit which has provided defendants with representation in Multnomah and Washington counties since the 1970s. If you know of any others, please email us at totalityradio@gmail.com. I'm Sam Bowman. This has been Totality of Circumstances for April 21st, 2020. Thank you for listening, and tune in to our next show on May 5th, or stream any of our shows on kboo.fm. I'll be joined next time by Jasmine Moneymaker, who provided most of the original reporting and data analysis for this week's show as well. Thanks also to KGW, the Portland Mercury, the Oregonian, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, and Model 500, and to you wonderful KBOO community members. Stay safe and be well. Thank you.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Hi, this is Emma. Before we begin the show this week, I would just like to let you all